Hey, this is Rob. This is episode 134 of the Folly Coffee Podcast. Let's get it brewing. All right. If you listened to the last episode, you may have heard me reference who I've got on this week, but I've got Pedro Walcott, owner and executive chef at Guacaya Bistro in the North Loop. If you're not familiar with it, it's that space that the Dunn Brothers used to be. But upon my first time going there, I go, you never would have known that this was a Dunn Brothers. And we talked about it a little bit because we just ran into each other, and my first experience radically different from the second. So I'm excited to kind of get into the launch of it, how it went from originally it was kind of like counter service and now it's full service, radically different experience, how that happened. But first, I am very excited to hear about your story, because as I referenced off mic, just as we're about to hop on, is this is not a Minnesota guy, which if you're not from Minnesota, you're like, yeah, that's normal. So it's like I lived in Chicago and you go, most people aren't from here. Then I moved to St. Louis. I go, oh, everyone is from here. And then Minnesota, maybe not quite as intense as St. Louis, but definitely that kind of like most people here are from here. So coming from New Orleans, is that where you were born and raised? What is your story? How did you get into food? How did you end up here in the Twin Cities?
Yeah, so I pretty much grew up in Panama. So I was born and raised in Panama, and very Caribbean, very Afro Caribbean, you know. My family is like super diverse. We go from pretty much like Skittles, from every spectrum of the rainbow. I'm pretty much the lightest guy in my family. Everybody is darker or black. And, you know, we just have a lot of Haitian influence, a lot of Caribbean influence in our blood. And, you know, coming from that kind of melting pot, it's just amazing. I think I'm just grateful that I was able to born in Panama and was raised in such a community like that. And pretty much, I come from a small town of 20,000 people, where dirt roads were, when I was growing up, were still a thing. We used to take showers in the river because the power and the water would go out for weeks. And we used to, like, literally, like, wash our clothes in the river. It's not even joking. So we didn't even watch that much TV because, like I said, power would go out long periods of time. And you know, when those like that, we're kind of like a developing country, but we're not, because we got the Panama Canal and so much influence from other countries. But I think it was a great, great childhood that I had, and I don't think I would trade it for anything. And so, yeah.
How long were you in Panama until like what age? Also, can you move the mic just a little closer?
Sure.
There we go. Perfect.
I was in Panama till like 17.
Oh, okay.
So, and first, like, my dad was working at the Panama Canal, and then one day the military bases were reverted back to the Panamanians. So one day my dad said, okay, guys, I think we got to move. So I didn't even know a word of English, anything. And he's like, well, guys, we're going to move to Slidell, Louisiana. And I'm like, what? What is this? What? So
at this point, living in Panama, did Louisiana mean anything to you? Like, in terms of, like, there's the United States and then there's Louisiana. Did you have any idea of where you were moving or what you were getting yourself into?
No, I had no idea where we were going. But my dad did say, this is the closest you're going to get to a Caribbean city or mimicking where you're from, you know?
Yeah.
So he said, you know, New Orleans would be the perfect city for you guys to, like, get acclimated. So it won't be so harsh on you guys. So if we went to a bigger city, I think it would be too much for you guys, he said. So he was right. New Orleans was the perfect city to move to from a city like Panama, because it's very similar.
So moving at 17 years old, that's such, like, a formidable age of, like, you're – not quite an adult, but you're definitely still not a kid anymore. And so what happened when you moved at 17 years old? Are you now going to, like, the local school? How are you, not without speaking any English, what is that transition like going from Panama to, like, the New Orleans area?
Yeah, so, like, for me, it was really, like, difficult first 5 years of my life here, because not knowing the language was, like, killer. Like, I couldn't find a girlfriend because I couldn't communicate. Not that it matters, but
what excuse do I have?
No, but like it's also like school. They wanted to put me down like a grade down, so I just ended up going back to Panama, finishing my high school in Panama. Then I came back, and then when I was in Panama, I went to a all English school because my dad wanted me to learn. So I came back and got a GED afterwards because. You know, I find out you could just do that and skip the whole entire school system. So it was so much easier. But it was still difficult. Like I said, it was trying to figure out the language, assimilating the culture a little bit. And I think New Orleans just, it's such a melting pot like Panama because, you know, in reference to Panama, the reason our cuisine is so diverse is because we had, when they were building the Panama Canal, there were so many cultures that came in and stayed. People from Haiti, people from the Dominican Republic, from Trinidad and Tobago, from Guyana. You name it, they came and they stayed to build the canal. Mm-hmm. Even before the Americans took over the canal construction, the French were in it. So we had a lot of French people too. So we have French, everything you can think of came through the Panama Canal and stayed. So yeah, very multicultural.
And that's... I've been to New Orleans once, and my take from it is this is the one place I've been in the U.S. that I go, this is not like anything else in the U.S., and that was a big takeaway. It is this mix of cultures that you're like, I've never experienced anything quite like it. The accents were like, I can't quite pin down what this accent is because it's so different from your traditional Southern accent. And it's this mixing of cultures and foods that just creates this landscape in terms of like food and drink that's unlike anything else. Not to mention like their laws are way crazier than anything else in the U.S. And I was like, and so that helped the transition as you go from Panama, because it sounds like with that infusion of all these different cultures in Panama, it sounds like maybe that was somewhat similar to New Orleans outside of having to like learn an entirely new language.
Yeah, even like you said, the laws, like not patriotic, like the different type of law than the rest of the country. And then we have parishes instead of counties. And I mean, like the accent, the Southern accent there is the most unique one. They don't say onions, they say onions. We don't say, like, yeah. We don't say shrimp, we say shrimps. And then, like, we say a lot of, we call everybody baby. So, hey, baby, how's it going? How you doing? Hey, darling, how's it going? What's going on? And then here you tell somebody, hey, baby, they look at you like, hey, don't call me baby. I don't know you, man. I don't know you. So a lot of cultural differences, I think, that are very unique to New Orleans that make it such a great city, I think.
So being 17, 18 years old, at this point, are you even able to form an idea of what do I want to do now that I'm here? Like, what is my life going to be? Or is it such a chaotic time that you're like, I just need to figure out what life is here first?
So, like, I was trying to figure out, like, what do I do? Like, you know, but then I kind of started watching Justin Wilson. I don't know if people know who that is. Mm-mm. In the South. So this Julia Childs is, yep, what most Northerners would like listen to.
Yeah.
If you're a Yankee, that's what you like. You listen to like Julia Childs. Everybody's like, oh, Julia Childs. We don't have that down South. So on PBS, Justin Wilson used to come on and make gumbo, make boudin, and he used to make all these like Cajun and Creole recipes. I used to love him. What's an onion? And then the guy never like measure anything. Everything was in the palm of his hands. And it's like, this is a teaspoon. And you will see it. He will measure it up as a teaspoon. And the guy never used the measuring anything in the whole entire recipes. He would just go by hand and by eye. So I kind of got used to that type of cooking where I see things with my eyes and I adjust it. Like I know how much I'm putting on. By the way, I put it in my palms. So it's kind of like we're way of cooking in the beginning.
Were you already into food at this point? Like, was cooking something you were actively doing, or was this kind of your first experience to be like, oh, I want to get more into this?
No, I think, like, cooking with my mom was huge and my grandma because, like, moving to New Orleans, and I didn't have the Caribbean food that I grew up with. Mm. So, like, it was always trying to, like, mimic those flavors. So I became really good at, like, using the whatever I could find in the city to make the recipes from Panama.
Mm.
So So I'm very good. Like, I try something and I can recreate it right away without it having to look or like any recipes. I can just like taste something and then go home and make it. And it would taste just like it.
So going from there, you're starting to, like, you're cooking, recreating these flavors from home. You discover the show and you start to kind of mimic this style of cooking, lots of eyesight and using your hand and just like really getting a feel for food. At what point did that lead you to saying, hey, you know, I'm going to take a go at this and actually get into the food, or the restaurant industry, the food business?
Yeah, I think when I was like a lot younger, like, I find out like very quickly that New Orleans was like a celebrity chef city, like New York City or San Francisco. Like, literally, you walk down the street, you see Paul Prudhomme, and it's like waving at you, and everybody wants to take pictures. It's like, for me, it was like, oh fuck, this is Paul Prudhomme right then in the wheelchair. Like, he was in an electric little cart, but he would come up and say hi, and everybody wanted to take pictures with him. And then you run into Emeril Lagasse back then, before the John Besh got into trouble. John Besh was a big deal in New Orleans. And then, like, getting to know Donald Link, Chef Donald Link, as well. Just so many, like, celebrity chefs in the city of New Orleans, or James Beard Award winners that shaped the city.
Mm-hmm.
And then having places like Commander's Palace that, like, man, it just, like, make you want to cook, you know. So it's such a city, like, built on – it's a chef city. Basically a cook city. When you go there, there's either chefs, cooks, students that go to Loyola or Tulane, or you're a doctor or you're a lawyer. That's it. We're a hospitality industry city, and that's all we do. Hotels, food, cocktails. Very straightforward. In like hospitality industry forward.
Yeah.
So yeah, so that kind of, you just fall in love with it. It's just kind of like the thing. You want to hang out with those cool chefs, and you want to be part of that, you know, get to know some of those crews, because it was pretty cool when those crew, different kitchen crews would get together. It's like crazy, man. You got like, this is some cool kids. And then, like, it makes you want to, like, cook more and be part of that culture.
Yeah.
Because it sucks you in. You're just like, and I know people, like, personally who went into, like, Tulane to become lawyers and ended up becoming chefs.
This is exactly what I was talking about with Graham a couple episodes ago, is like, that's such a common experience, that wide variety of places, different types of, whether you're just like, at the time he's washing dishes and he's like, but my favorite thing was just the culture and the people. You go, it's just so much fun that it just kind of sucks you in. So where was the first place that you approached to be like, can I work here? Or what was the first job that you had that got you into it?
So, like, I remember, like, John Besh book came out in 2004. And then, like, I wrote him a so the lady from the bookstore, this is right next to Commander's Palace. The lady from the bookstore, and this is also, like, uptown New Orleans. So I went and bought his book. So that was my first cookbook. It was John Besh, like, family cooking, you know. And the lady was like, oh, man, she's like, you're pretty young, and I know John Besh, so, like, he'll sign it for you and everything. I was like, oh, shit. Like, I have my book signed by John Besh. I've never met the guy. So she went and got the book signed. And then before she went and got the book signed, I wrote a letter to him. It's like, hey, chef, I would love to come, like, learn to cook with you and all that. And she gave him the letter. And he's like, he replied back, like, he has my phone number.
I can say confidently that's the first time I've heard that on terms of how somebody got their first job.
Yeah, it's like, here's my phone number. Come hit me up if you ever need a job. And I kind of saved the letter in the book. I thought it was cool.
Yeah.
And then I saved it. And then, you know, I was still trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life. My mom just kind of went through breast cancer. She had breast cancer. So my plans to become a cook were, like, put on hold. So thankfully she survived. And then right after that, then Katrina hits.
Jeez.
So now one thing after another. So, like, my mom, thankfully she's still with us. She survived breast cancer. And then right after that, I was getting ready to go call this man and be like, hey, let me get a job in your kitchen, just peeling potatoes, whatever. and then Katrina hits. And then just like everything goes to hell. So anyways, it all happens and things happen for a reason. So
yeah, but that is a absolutely crazy series of events to happen. What was that time like?
Oh my God, it was like a survival mode. And I feel like going through Katrina and all that period in my life, it makes you like appreciate life more. It makes you hungrier and also makes you tougher. It gives you like alligator skin. I mean, like nothing, I feel like going through that, nothing is hard.
Yeah, one of my favorite quotes is like, the hardest thing you've ever done or gone through is the hardest thing you've ever done or gone through. So if you've never experienced something that challenging or difficult, small things can really disrupt you. And when you go through something like that, I imagine in your life, you go, well, nothing's ever going to be as challenging as that period of time in my life.
I don't think it would never will be, but it made me tough, I don't know, in a way that I don't think that most people went through Katrina think about life differently. And even with me, I still got PTSD about Katrina, because like, even though I'm not in New Orleans, when I hear that there's a hurricane going over, my anxiety takes over. Even though I'm not home.
Yeah.
But like
you're in Minnesota, as far away from hurricane, and so but even hearing that still brings up those memories.
And then I don't even watch documentary, none of that shit, because it's just like a why rehash thing that you just don't want to.
And so how do you even begin to recover from that? Like because still I'm thinking about you at 17 years old coming in, not speaking the language, going back, going to an English school, learning the language, coming back, getting a handwritten letter from the chef that you got the cookbook, and you're like, I'm going to be able to do this. Then going through that with breast cancer with your mom and then Hurricane Katrina, like what is the process of like even moving forward from that point? Because that's such a level of I don't mean to be smiling, because it's like this is so overwhelming that I'm crazy, one of those nervous smilers. But like, how do you even begin to work your way back from that?
Well, so things that are happening is I got a, you know, I ended up getting a letter from a friend that worked in Las Vegas at the Rio. So he said, hey man, they're taking people in, like, you know, they'll put you in a place for like a few weeks, and they'll give you a job as a cook here in the kitchen, and you're up for it. And then first I made sure that, you know, my mom and my dad were taken care of, you know, pops and mom did. So they were great. The great thing about my parents are like, dude, go out there and just jump in the water. You'll never know, or you'll regret it if you don't do it. So my dad rent me a U-Haul, got me a few things from like Salvation Army, just enough so I can put stuff in to not just have a mattress, but actually have some furniture. I saved up some money and saved up for like 2 months of rent. Thankfully I had some family that lived in Vegas, and they kind of helped me with the whole process. So I moved to an apartment, had 2 months of, you know, rent ready to go, and then I started the job at the Rio.
And was this your first job in food?
Yeah, my first job, like, professionally in food.
So you go all the way out to Las Vegas, start this food job. What is that job like? Was it what you expected, or, like, how does it go from there?
It was really hard. Like, this is the name, William Becker. Mm-hmm. Those who know the Las Vegas industry, working with William Becker was hard as shit. Like, he's one of the old school chefs, almost working like Charlie Trotter. Like, it's really hard.
Yeah, like old school French mentality, like feelings, leave them at the door. That doesn't matter here. Work-life balance, not a real thing. Like, none of that.
No, I think I was one of the last in my generation, I guess, to go through that kind of intense training where life is like working at the Rio. And I only worked there for over a year with him at the Rio. And then I was working at the Buddha Steakhouse on the 37th floor, or the last floor of the hotel, which was great. Also, it was like a New Orleans restaurant. Hmm. So it was kind of funny that my first restaurant job ended up being a restaurant in New Orleans in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. So I was learning French cuisine from William Becker and Chef Chris Crotter. William Becker was the executive chef for Harrah's Casinos in Las Vegas. So he managed the Bally's, Harrah's, the pretty much like the Paris, all the Harrah's Casinos. Yeah. But I didn't realize that I was going to end up working at the one restaurant that he looks up, or it's his baby, as he call it, the Buddha Steakhouse.
Yeah.
The Rio. So it was hell, like, with this guy. He walk in, throw shit at you, and I pick that out. That's not what I like. I don't like this. This is crazy. Work clean, tucking your elbows. Only, like, he used to tell, like, chefs that get burned, like, they don't know what they're doing. Like, a lot of chefs have, like, burns everywhere.
Yeah, like forearms, wrists, like hands.
Yeah, and he's like, those are idiots or those are clowns. Like, they don't know how to work properly. So in his mind, he said, chefs that get burnt in their, like, hands or in their, like, it was supposed to be something that they were not very organized or weren't taught properly. So I never got burnt. Just so if you look at my hands, you can see him. So my first job as a cook, I'm thinking, man, I see all these chefs that got burnt everywhere. They must be a bunch of clowns, because this guy told me that was the reason that they don't know how to cook, tuck in their elbows. Yeah. They always get burnt, or they don't use towels. So I never got burnt because he told me.
Just that one tip.
Yeah, and then I put my elbows in, so I never got burnt, and I always used towels. So by God behold, I never have those. And some of them, like, some of the chefs in New Orleans think that's like a pride thing. Like, yeah. Oh, yeah, look at all the burns I have here. Like a tally.
Yeah, it's like same with baristas who, like, have lost feeling in their hands from burning themselves on, like, steam pitchers and coffee so much. Like, I don't even feel it anymore. It's like this sense of pride that it's like, I get burned all the time.
Oh, yeah, man, I got this. Look at that. 20 lines in my hands.
And so you said, were you at Buddha first, or was that where you were for a year? Or is the Buddha in the Rio, or is that separate?
Buddha Steakhouse.
Buddha.
Yep. And then I met Alon Shaya also by coincidence. This is before Alon Shaya opened his restaurant group in New Orleans, right before he went to Italy. And then he moved to New Orleans and opened up Shaya, best restaurant in the country. And then it was, you know, that the industry, when you're working at those restaurants, is really small. Like, it's not as big as you think. They all know each other, all the chefs. So, like, wherever I would go, like, if that's why for me it's like, don't burn the bridge, because wherever you go at that high level things, like, they all know each other. Like, it's so weird.
Yeah, and it's like it's being connected with names is either the greatest thing that could happen to you, or it's the worst thing that could happen to you. Yep. Because if you went into Voodoo and all of a sudden they hated you, and it sounds like he probably had pretty strong opinions about people.
Yep.
That's like, if he likes you, you go, that's awesome, I can attach his name. It's a small world. But on the flip side, if he sees burns on your forearms, he's like, don't hire that clown.
Out of here. You don't know how to cook. He's not organized. So it was things like that. You just kind of, it's weird because, like, you take, once you get older and you realize, like, the life lessons you learn with people, you just want to keep the good shit, and then the old stuff, just get rid of it.
I think that's a very simple and effective way to do that. I try to do that as much as possible. So you were in Vegas. How long were you in Vegas? Was it all at Voodoo, or did you end up?
So, you know, after like a year working with him, that guy was maniac. But it's great. Like, you can Google the guy, William Becker, Harrah's Casinos. Mm-hmm. You'll see all about him. But
this is public information you're sharing. Yeah. It's not a secret.
Not a secret, man. People who know him know. And then after that, I met Chef Emmanuel Sopas from Germany, from Brussels, Germany. You know, I was still green, you know, like learning. I kind of, like, you know, wanted to try banquets because, one, the hours were a little bit better. Mm-hmm. And I could get a part-time, too, to buy a car.
Mm.
So I decided to, you know, Chef Emmanuel kind of offered me a position there. I went to Stosh for like a whole month.
A whole month?
Yeah, man.
For anyone listening that doesn't know, a stage is basically like you're shadowing for free. Just like usually a stage is one session and it's like, is it a good fit?
Maybe a day.
Are we going to maybe, yeah, a day of like, let's see if we want to hire this person or have them on their team. And so you were doing a stage for a month.
Yeah, for a month. And usually like in, like right now, like in 90 seconds, I'll know if this person will work out or not.
Yeah.
It's really simple. Like you'll know. But right now is we can't pick and choose who we get. The industry here is changing, but that's another subject.
Yeah, we're gonna get into that. I'm very curious to hear your opinions. But so you start doing banquets, kind of part time with. You said it was Emmanuel, is his name?
Emmanuel Sopas, and then I met the executive chef of the Venetian Palazzo, Olivier Dubriel. So, and everybody knows Chef Olivier. He's one of the master chef of France, in the country, outside of France too. So
Vegas had to have been such a unique place to do it. Like I've been a couple times and to me it was like, oh, this is where chefs go to show off as much as possible because Vegas is so grandiose and everything is so big and vibrant. And like, you literally can't be tacky because everything's so big that like chefs will go in and be like, I'm just going to go all out and show off as much as possible. So you do attract some incredible talent of people saying that I'm going to show off in the most grandiose way and you can charge for it and it's a great opportunity, but you do have this intense concentration of chefs from around the world.
Yeah. And that was really great too. Cause like, and so right before I was doing part-time, then I got offered the chef turn on job, which is a sous chef position. So that was great. Cause I was thinking about leaving and going to culinary school. And Chef Emmanuel was like, no, I'm going to teach you everything you need to know here. Because like we were teaching like CIA students how to like pick time. And I was just.
The Culinary Institute students. At first I was thinking the CIA, the Culinary Institute. Yeah.
So they would come in and like, I'm just taught it, but you know, by the chef at the kitchen.
Yeah.
So I ended up doing almost like an apprenticeship with Chef Emmanuel. But like I could see that these young students would come in and they didn't know how to pick time because they would just put the whole stick in. And she was like, what the hell is this? Go back and pick it. Pick it right. Pick it properly. And it's like I'm teaching these young students from CIA how to like pick time.
Do some of the basics. And this was another thing that came up on Graham's episode because he did go to culinary school and left because he's like, you know, if I'm going to have an opportunity to get, how do I fillet this one steak or something like that? Then it's like, you can't do it over and over because that would get too expensive. So here's your one time to try it. Now try it. Whereas in a kitchen setting, learning from the person that's teaching you, guess what? If you're picking time, you got to pick a lot of time. So you're going to get very proficient, very fast, and then also get good at the repetition, which is like such an important part of being good in a kitchen.
And I think we used to do banquets for 100,000 people. So so it's like it makes you efficient.
100,000 people.
Yeah. Just like this room would be a cook and chill machine. Just like we used to grow like 10,000 pieces of chicken. And then bag them, cryo back them, and then they would go into this conveyor belt and drop them in like a look like a laundry machine but it's actually a sous vide machine. So
that is a really good way to get very proficient at something is if you have to do it 10,000 times. Most people, if they're like, I want to learn how to do this, even to find a place to try it 10,000 times, you'd have to be there for years. And I'm like, I'm doing that in a night.
Yeah, so it's an orchestra and you need like a good executive chef experience. Like most of the chefs from any hotel in Las Vegas, they either come from France, the Caribbean, they have a lot of experience doing banquets. Mm-hmm. And then most of the front of the house, they come from, what's that Ivy League school in New York City?
Oh, Columbia?
Not Columbia.
It's the only one in New York City.
It's in Hideaway, close to CIA. There's
it's like Yale and Harvard up in that area, Boston.
There is a hospitality Ivy League school.
Oh, there is?
Yeah. So most of the hotel.
Oh, maybe Cornell.
Cornell.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah,
Cornell
University. Yep. They've got the hospitality school.
Yep. So they're the top leader. So it means that all the hotels are run by Cornell
students. That's right. Yeah. Cornell has that big hotel and hospitality program.
So like the Venetian Palazzo won't hire you for front of the house unless you're a Cornell graduate.
Mm.
Yeah. That's the way it is.
Las Vegas, baby.
So, yeah, man. So I remember like they would also come in. So it would people from CIA and then people from Cornell will come in and do their training, whatever they do. I don't know what they call it, but yeah, man, we had to talk to them and show them what we're doing.
It's that whole joke when you start working somewhere and they go, this is how they tell you to do it. This is how we actually do it.
Yeah, man. And it was great, man. And then like the chef Emmanuel used to work in Cuba in a hotel in Cuba, so he knew Spanish perfectly, so it was great. He could talk to me in Spanish, train me. His Spanish was perfect. You know, those guys from, like, Europe, they speak, like, eight languages.
Yeah.
Like, it's nobody's business. And I was like, yeah, I speak that. Speak patois. He worked in Jamaica, a club med.
That's got to be such a huge advantage in a kitchen when you're working with so many different flavors to be able to talk at high-level detail about things and not just trying to find the middle ground of, you know, what do I know, what do you know, and how can we try to communicate this?
And so Shep used to work at Ocharia Club Med, and he fixed for me to go to work in Jamaica for 6 months.
And did you do it?
Yeah, I did.
What was that like?
No cell phones. That was, you know, cell phones weren't what they were today, man.
Yeah.
So I couldn't even take pictures. I kind of just lived the moment, right?
Yeah.
Because the cell phone didn't take off until 2010. So it's like around that time. And then, like, I went to Club Med. And then there was a lot of people from Cirque du Soleil there. And then we were just there cooking, you know, whatever came out from the ocean. And this is in Ocharia, Jamaica. So the great thing about it is, like, Panama has a lot of Jamaicans. Then going to Ocharia, learning more about Jamaican cuisine is amazing. So I incorporated a lot into my cuisine is Jamaican food.
Yeah, talk about such a concentration of experience. Because I think most people, when they think of experience, they just think of time. How long have you been doing it? But if you were to tell me that, you go, how many years was that in all? Because, I mean, it was like a year.
That was like in the first 3 years.
That's 3 years. That's what I'm saying, is if I met someone and I was like, how long have you been in the industry? And they're like, 3 years. I'd be like, oh, okay. You're just getting started. But then you're talking about your experience and you're talking about doing 10,000 meals in a night for a banquet of 100,000 people. And then you're in Jamaica for 6 months and then you're meeting this chef and that chef and like getting all these concentrated experience, like, in such a wide variety of areas is a cool thing, too, that it's like, yeah, it's only 3 years, but the amount of work that must have been done in that three. And you must have been pretty damn good early on, because to be able to even be given the opportunity, for, whether it's like the banquet job or working in these kitchens, like how, and I don't know how to phrase this other than like, how were you able to do it with no prior experience?
Well, like in the beginning when you don't have like culinary school, like, you know, I needed to work brunch. I remember I used to break every egg when I was trying to flip it. Mm. So I used to go on my day off and go through a whole case of eggs. And the chef didn't care because as long as I was, you know, I was trying to perfect the technique. So something as simple as flipping an egg can be something really intimidating for a first-time cook.
Was that something that someone said you should do this, like come in and do this? Or were you like, I just want to get better. I want to go in and do this.
I just want to get better. I'm just going to do it because I don't want to be embarrassed or I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So I did that. I went through a whole case of eggs and then like broke half of them. I was successful for the other one, but then you get the hang that it's all about the risk, you know. And then you just get better at what you do, man. Like doing pizza, same thing. We had to do pizza for like 600 people. Then, you know, just went and did pizza in-suite dining for like a whole like day for free. And I used to do all the pizza. I didn't even get paid. I just went in and just wanted to learn. And then the chef that was there making pizza was like from Italy. So he just teach me like do this. And then you just kind of get better at that.
But it's so bizarre when you're telling your story because, like, I'm sure to you, you're like, this is just my life. This is just how it went. And I'm going, like, you went from New Orleans after that period of time in your life that's just like devastating to moving to Las Vegas to all of a sudden you're learning to make pizza from this fantastic Italian chef. You're doing banquets for 10 to 100,000 people. You're working in some of the best restaurants with some of the best chefs around the world. At that time, did you have something in your mind of like, this is what I have an idea of what I want to do long term? Or was it just something that you were like, this is a great opportunity, so I'm just going to do as much as possible?
No, so the way I figured out this is going to be what I wanted to do the rest of my life is because Chef Emmanuel told me, like, I was in the same shoes as you were when I was your age. I didn't know what to do after high school. So the difference between Europe and the U.S., Western world, is like when you don't have anything to do, there's trade programs that you just join because you're not going to sit there not doing anything.
Yeah.
So I didn't know what I was going to do, so I decided to just join a apprenticeship program for culinary, industry in Brussels, Germany. And then that's what kicked off my career, and pretty much he didn't have to pay for culinary school. And those programs are there for people when they don't have a need of wanting to go to college. So
just seeing him being like, oh, he at one point was in a similar position to me and this is where he is now. That's kind of like, I don't know when or how it'll happen, but just knowing that it is possible, that's kind of what inspired, just like, if I just keep working as hard as possible at this, it'll get me closer to what he's doing.
Correct. And I guess he liked me a lot too, because I crack a lot of jokes.
Honestly, it's like, dude, if you're good, maybe it shouldn't be this way, but being a good hang, like being fun to hang around, is a big part in a lot, like any work environment that can get you a long way. If people are like, we want them around, then you're going to be around more, then you're going to pick up on more things. And if you kind of capitalize on that opportunity, which it sounds like you did, going in your time off making pizzas for free, can put you in a really good spot.
Well, that's just that it's like getting every day up, and doing your very best. Like the thing I learned is like the chef used to always like drilling me, like, leave it better than you found it. And then and this is something I have tattooed him. It's like, there's no shame. My grandfather told me this, there's no shame in hard work, and hard work will never betray you. And he has never betrayed me. And I don't give a shit that I work hard and harder than anybody else, so they never question my work ethic. And that's just the way it is, because that's how I was trained early on. You work harder than the next person next to you. You work harder than anybody else, so they don't ever question you. And that's just the way it is. I'm old school like that, but I know that people like me are far in between. There are very few, but there are people who like are from that era. But like I said, well, that's just what drive me, because my grandfather used to tell me, man, a man that gets up every day in the morning will provide for their family. Dude, those things, when people tell me things like that, I remember those things.
Yeah, it's such a simple concept that like hard work, but now we're in this interesting age and where, like, what is the definition of hard work?
Right.
And I'm not going to sit on a soapbox and talk about it, because I know a lot of people that work a lot harder than me, right. But in my mind, exactly like you said, it's like, you don't know how anything's going to turn out. The odds, especially in the food and beverage industry, are stacked wildly against you. Yes. Like, if you start something in this industry, you're going into it knowing that the odds are 9 out of 10, this doesn't work or this doesn't happen. But it's definitely not going to happen if you don't work as hard as possible or really focus on it.
I mean, just open a restaurant, dude. You have to like go above and beyond. Like, it was.
I don't think people appreciate how crazy people are that open restaurants.
You have to be crazy.
I think it's because what you read about in the paper, what you see posted on social media, what you're seeing the success stories. You're rarely seeing something just close down. And so, to the average person, it's like, no, restaurants seem like a great business. You go, not no. 8 out of 10 of them, 80, 90% of them are not. And just like this constant churning of different locations and different concepts. Yep. That's why I'm so excited to get even closer to opening Guacaya, because I was like, anytime I see a new restaurant, I'm like, here's another crazy person. Let's see what we got here.
And like, that's just like the story is just like halfway through my.
I know.
It even gets crazier than this.
We're in the first 3 years of what you've been doing so far.
And this, and like I said, the only reason I was able to do that is one, I didn't have kids.
Yeah.
And that helped. That kind of like put you in a, you know, spot because my other peers are older than me and they have families.
I've said that about starting Follies. I was like, I didn't have any real responsibilities. Like, yeah, of course you have personal responsibilities, but I don't have anyone depending on me. That does put you in a unique position.
Right. And I thought to myself, like, my first 10 years, I'm going to dedicate it to the industry. Hard work hard those 10 years and then learn. And then that was my mindset going into it. Like, I need to do better. Like, if I'm not going to go to culinary school, I need to be better than those. You know, I would say, you know, the CIA students or whoever comes in, I have to be able to show up and demonstrate that I belong. So
next level, because I had a similar idea, except mine was about a year. I was like, I'm going to have 1 year where I disappear and I don't have a social life. So it'd be like 10 years. I'm like, damn, he had the long-term vision ready to go.
No, and I mean, and then around that time, then like the Venetian was just the Venetian. Then they started building the Palazzo next to it. So things got a little bit more complicated because they moved the banquet kitchen to the other side. And we had to open the Venetian Palazzo. So that was pretty intense itself. And then, like, that was a pretty fun experience opening a hotel of that magnitude, especially the banquet's kitchen, because this is when we got the big, like sous vide machine.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, which is, like, the size of people's apartment. Like, people won't believe me. Like, you have to go down there because the underground, like, underneath those hotels, it's like an ant. Entness,
yeah.
Like tunnels that go everywhere.
You're just seeing the tip of the iceberg with hotels.
You just see what's beautiful above, but if you go underneath it, or if you happen to like go in one of those doors, I would tell people just take a chance, go in. I used to do that all the time in the hotels. I would just go in and see what's back there. It's crazy. It's crazy. I could tell you stories about Vegas and those back rooms and where they.
I think
take
this
you.
Would turn into a 4-hour podcast right about now.
No, but like so. Fast forward, like. They opened the Venetian Palazzo. I was there. And then they had to open the Venetian Macau. So they shipped me to China to open Macau.
Venetian Again, Macau, another China. Stop. It's like, yeah, no, that's normal. Yep. So,
yeah, we opened the hotel in Macau. And Macau is just like Jersey City, like casinos.
Yeah.
Like if you go to like in Mississippi, they also have like a small little concentration of casinos in Gulfport. So there's places like that all over the world, but in Macau, China is like dope. And everybody, it's a lot of Portuguese people, language. A lot of people speak English there predominantly. So it's like, it was really easy for me to go there because the executive chef there was like, spoke English and everything. And we just kind of helped them set up the system, what we had in Vegas over there.
And how long were you over there?
Well, for like 3 months.
Okay.
And then like, it was a great experience. And back home, and then they hired a whole entire staff from Asia, and then I went back home.
And when you say home,
back to Las Vegas,
but back to Las Vegas, okay.
Yeah. And there,
because at this point I'm like, there's like five homes listed so far.
It's crazy. Like, Vegas takes it. And when we started working, then the James Beard started happening. I forgot what year was it. And it was like Trista Jardine, and then it was Fabio Tabrioshi from Washington, D.C., and then Donald Link from New Orleans. So when I heard Donald Link was in town and he was going to be at the Venetian Palazzo working out of our kitchen, I immediately volunteered to work for him. So I volunteered for Donald Link, and then they did the James Beard tasting, and then... I don't know what happened because we didn't get to see the service. We were cooks. We don't get to see the fun stuff in front of it.
But yeah, you just make it and go, I hope they like it. We'll hear later.
And then, like, Fabio Tarashi, which Chef Chris, who works at Spoon and Stable, that's his mentor. So I kind of told him one day, I was like, yeah, man, like, I worked with him at the James Beard, like, a while back. See how they all know each other?
Yeah.
So he asked me, and he speaks perfect Spanish, Fabio. So he's Italian. So he goes back and tells me, like, hey, Pedro, like, you know where I can find some cheese? So, yeah, what do you need? It's like, I need this type of cheese. That's all you need? So it's like, okay. So I don't know what cheeses they have back there, but I took them to the Bolt which is like about, I would say a good 700 cheeses. Uh-huh. It's a room full of cheese. Half the size of my restaurant. So I'm like, right here, chef. And the chef just looked at me crazy like, this is impossible. What is all this? And he's just like a candy store for children.
Yeah.
Every cheese you can think of, we had it. So that's how I met him. And he's like, yeah, man, if you're in Washington, you get a job. But that's how you find a job.
Yeah?
Yeah. And then I ended up helping Steven, Chef Steven, and Chef Donald. And it was amazing because they're from New Orleans.
And this was still in Vegas that you're helping. Yeah, you're there, so they're in town in Vegas and you're helping them.
And I still haven't worked a job in New Orleans. So, well, anyways, it came time for me to like, okay, you know, I did Vegas 7-8 years. Then the economy went down around that time.
Like 2008, 2009?
No, we survived that, but I think it was just getting a little slower.
Mm.
And I was just kind of getting
burnt out. How long ago was this period of time? So like you're 7 or 8 years?
My 7 or 8 year into Vegas. And I was kind of just getting burnt out. Like, and by the way, the first year in Vegas, I partied every single day. I wasn't 21, but when I turned 21, yeah, I went out every single weekend.
Oh my God, you must have been so exhausted.
I used to go out with me and my friends. And like, when you don't have kids and you don't know anything. But
yeah.
I remember me and my friend Jose now, but we used to go out like every night. It felt like it. For 365 days, about 300 of them, we went out every night.
Jeez.
Because you're 21 in Vegas.
Yeah, and crazy. You're like, I can be tired tomorrow.
You saw Mike Tyson with a tiger in the middle of the street. It's true. It's like, you think it's a movie, but it's like, you see crazy stuff, man.
Yeah.
And I can just tell you stories in Vegas. I've seen the most outrageous stuff in Vegas, I would say. That in New Orleans. But so we did the James Fair Award with Donald Link. Chef tells me, hey, if you're ever in New Orleans, come find me, and I'll get you a job. So I was like, all right, whatever. Then like a year later, I decided to move back home to New Orleans, mm-hmm. Be with the family. I kind of miss them a lot. So I think I learned enough to work in a kitchen because I think I felt not confident working in New Orleans in a kitchen without any training.
Mm-hmm.
I think I could have done it, but because of Katrina, it just led me to Vegas. So I came. So prior to going to New Orleans, I went and I remember Chef Ludo Lefebvre was working at, what was that restaurant in the Venetian? So I kind of got a part-time with Chef Ludo at the Venetian Palazzo. Gosh, I forgot the name of the restaurant. It's really beautiful. It was a beautiful restaurant. You had like Tao, you had Sushi Samba, you had a... Charlie had a restaurant, and Malagasy had one too. Everybody had a restaurant in the Venetian Palazzo. Even JC, the 4040 Club. Crazy. So I get it. That was like the first, I would say, Chef Ludo Lefebvre was the first like celebrity chef that I got to work for.
Yeah.
This guy, full tooted up, tatted up, tattoos everywhere. Cool guy, man. French accent. Really good friends with Chef Emmanuel. And, mm-hmm. Used to come into the kitchen, ask for shit all the time. We're like, sure, chef. But the guy was super fucking cooler than cool.
Yeah.
I mean, super fly, right? So I get a part-time there, and he's doing phenomenal stuff, you know, French cuisine. And then one night, like, tell you a story. One night, Paris Hilton comes in. Mm-hmm. This is when Paris Hilton was hyped super the thing. And she comes to the kitchen. He grabs her and, like, picks her up by her butt. And her butt's showing to all the chefs, all the cooks. Oh, and he's just like making out with her right there.
Did they know each other? I guess what happens in Vegas gets podcasted about.
No, but this is like a long time ago.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah.
Chef didn't have kids or anything, man. And then, I followed the French to LA. So he said, I'm going to do Ludo Bites. Come on, chef, like if you're in California, can check it out. So and then I'm moving to Long Beach, California, because I just wanted to live in LA for a little bit and be like, shit, I lived in LA.
Yeah.
That's freaking dope, right?
Yeah.
So I ended up working with him at Ludo Bite, his new restaurant,
mm-hmm.
after he left Las Vegas. And that was pretty fun. But I feel like LA was super big.
Yeah.
It was a lot of, like, it took me like 40 minutes to commute. It was insane.
Yeah, it's. I've heard the traffic is supposed to be absolutely like soul crushing.
It's horrible, man. And but I did love enjoying living it. I think I just wanted to live in LA for a little bit, just to say I lived in LA.
Yeah.
I didn't think I got anything culinary wise. I think I would have moved to San Francisco, but then I know I couldn't afford it because it's really expensive.
Yeah.
So LA was the next best thing, and then from there I got to know Tijuana, Rosarito, all the party cities, San Diego. And just kind of have a good time down there. And I think I just took a little break from Vegas right there before moving back home. And then when I moved back home, I went and I thought I was going to go to John Besh. But then I find out that they're like competing groups, Besh group versus Link group.
Mm-hmm.
And either you pick one and you stay with it. You don't switch. You don't jump boats. There's a sense of pride and who you work for in New Orleans,
yeah,
that perceives people. So, like, for some reason, Chef Donald, I met him, said, come get a job. And as soon as I walked in there, he put me to work right away. I didn't even have to stash or do anything.
A little but different than your 1 month stash.
He said, you know what? Come, start tomorrow. Just bring your apron, your knives. Let's go. And that was it. Then the whole John Besh thing dwindled because I already part embedded into me that I'm part of Link's restaurants. And we're really proud people. And when I tell you, like, it's like if you're proud of being from a county or parish or like in New Orleans, we're like, you're proud about everything. Like, if you're from the 9 ward, you're proud of being from the 9. If you're from the 7 ward, hard heads, that's what they said. You're proud of being from the 7th ward. If you're from the 3rd ward, you're proud of being from the 3rd ward. Same thing with the kitchens. When you go to a restaurant group, you're proud that you work for that group. Like Shaya group now with Alon Shaya. So like if you work for his restaurant group, you're like proud of being part of that team.
Yeah.
So like I was working at one day and I remember Chef Alon was working with John Besh at this time. They were partners. And then he came in and offered me a job because we worked together at the Buddhist, Buddha the Real.
Yeah.
This is like a long time ago. I don't even think they remember that. But the chef that was working at Cochon said, man, if they try to fucking poach you, sorry.
No, you're good.
I'll walk in his restaurant, pull my pants, and take a piss in your freaking lobby. It was like that, dude. I was like, damn. So. And that's what I'm telling you. Like,
it sounds like they're pretty territorial.
Oh, are you kidding me? I'm like, poaching is like, it's such a bad thing in New Orleans. People try to poach
you. This just came up a couple episodes ago, and I was like, I would think it'd be really bad. And apparently, here, it's not that big of a deal.
It's not big of a deal in New Orleans. It's like, shit, you try to poach people.
That's everything down there, it sounds like.
Dude, it's everything. It's like, so I was, even though I wanted to always work for Besh Group, it's just already.
Yeah, you already put your flag on one side of that battle.
I was already committed to the Donald Link. And I learned a lot because this is like going back home to learn how to cook Creole and Cajun cuisine was important. I think I already knew the basics because, we cook, gumbo and things like that. When I moved back home, people told me 100 times a gumbo recipe and I'm yet to see a bad one. So it's like people really rely on home cooking there. Like, for you to like not cook at home and go to a restaurant, it means that you're doing something right. Because 9 out of 10, you go to somebody's house, holy shit, man, you're in it for.
So it's like this odd level of competition that it's just there's such a great food culture down there that you're not just competing with the other restaurants. You're making them decide. Is it even worth going out? Because is this place going to be better than what me or my family or friends might be cooking?
Yeah, man, because you hear it all the time. I think my gumbo's better. My mama gumbo's better. Like, I think I make gumbo better than this. Like, everybody's always have a better way of doing things.
Yeah.
So it's very, like, you have to do something special for people to get out and come to your restaurant. And the reason I say that, that's just for locals. Because if you're, most of our clientele, when we worked in New Orleans, we're tourists.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So to have a local go see you, then you're doing something right.
Yeah. So how did you end up in Minnesota? Because I thought we were going to get there like nine stops ago.
No, this is crazy. No,
man,
I didn't even, so no insult to anyone. I really love Minnesota, Minneapolis, the Twin Cities, but I did not know Minnesota existed until I met my wife.
I think that's fair. I went to school out east. If you told half the people in Boston, you said, can you point out Minnesota on a map? They probably wouldn't be able to. It's pretty crazy.
I thought it was Canada, just to be, you know.
Yeah, well, to be fair, it basically is in a lot of ways.
Oh, but my wife, she's her family's from New Orleans too, and she's Creole. So, and then her dad moved up here like when she was young, mm-hmm. to work at Mayo Clinic. So that's I hear a lot of that. Like, yeah, my parents moved here when I was young, and they're working at the Mayo Clinic.
Yeah.
That's still the case. Mr.
Definitely still the case. Like, Mayo Clinic's still one of the best hospitals and hospital networks in the country.
And then her mom worked at IBM mm-hmm. In Rochester. So they all moved here. And I think, just so you know, like, they were one of the first few African-American families in Rochester. This is what my in-law tells me. You know, my mother-in-law, man, she's from the Seven Ward, man.
Yeah.
Hard heads. I tell you.
Yeah. That takes a lot of guts to move to a city like Rochester at a time like that. That takes some real gumption to be able to say, I'm going to do that.
But, you know, even when I go back home to, like, my in-laws, to their home, I still feel like I'm in New Orleans, because when I talk to them, it's yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. It's, like, very Southern, no, ma'am, yes, ma'am. Like, I get into that Southern mode with
them.
But then you leave that, and you're like, okay, we're not. I just like, I feel like I'm in the South.
Mm-hmm. and so, at what point did you move up here? And was it for your time, your girlfriend? Is that what you said?
Yeah. So I met my current my wife right now, mm-hmm. and I met her in New Orleans.
Okay.
And she was going to Tulane University. So that's what I'm saying. Like, either chefs, lawyers, students going to the university, and we met there, and she's like, yeah, I'm from Minnesota and whatever.
What is that?
I was like, okay, like, great. Like, and then, you know, things got serious. And then, like, she's like, it's time for you to come to Minnesota. Like, all right, I meet the parents, right? It's like a big step. This thing's getting serious.
Oh, so this is just a visit. She's not saying we're moving. She's saying, hey, you should come to Minnesota to meet my parents.
And I go to meet the parents. It was snowing, and it was crazy, dude. So I always thought, like, in the movies, because think about it, coming from Panama, I'd never been anywhere cold. And I always think about the movies. And, you know, when I look at this stuff, a lot of this stuff, even L.A., when I was in L.A., I thought about the movies. It's because all this stuff, I'd seen it as a kid. And I never thought I was going to leave Panama.
Mm.
So when I look at snow, I thought it was the craziest thing ever, right? Like, mind-blowing to me. I was like, I'll watch this shit in a 20,000, like, dirt road town. And here I am, not watching it from the TV when I was a kid. I'm actually here watching snow and all that.
Yeah.
So I went crazy. You know, I was just almost got freeze to death because I wanted to be outside and play in the snow and do all this stuff. And, but yeah, man, it was really fun. And I came here and I thought it was great, and then she showed me, like, the Twin Cities a little bit. And I was like, okay, like, there wasn't much of a culinary scene back then. I think Chef Gavin Kinsman just opened up his restaurant, but then mm-hmm. that was the only name I knew.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not local, so, like, I didn't know about Tim McKee or Tim Niver or Christina or Chef Ann and Alma, Chef Roberts. So all this, I didn't know about anyone mm-hmm. because those names are not talked about outside of Minnesota.
Yeah.
Like Gavin Kaysing is because he's a brand.
Yeah.
You know. So I didn't think about it too much. And then, you know, when I came to visit a couple of times, they used to tell me, like, you know what? They come back. I was like, what does that mean? Like, yeah, man, like, when you meet a girl from down here or a guy, they come back home. I was like, nah, seriously? Like,
I'm an example of that too.
I was like, yeah, man, like, people come back home, but it's a great city to live in and all that. And I was like, okay. And, like, fast forward, like, 4 or something years later, we've been together for 8 years. And then kind of when I met my wife, it's like, I told her one day, it's like, one day I'm going to have a restaurant. I don't know how, I don't know when, and I don't know, but it's going to happen. I just don't know. I know that it's going to happen. I know it in me. Like, it's one of those things that you just know. So, and then, you know, I didn't migrate all the way from Central America here to not see my dreams go through, right?
Yeah, so, after moving to like 20 other places in the meantime, getting all the experiences to just not go after it.
Right. And then, like, I just told her, like, you know, it's what I like. I'm now so involved in the industry that I'm falling in love with the industry. And really, I this is my profession. This is what, you know, pay my bills, what I love. It's like
industry is a little bit like Minnesota that way. It's like if you leave the industry, it's like you'll be back.
Yeah. and you know, and we don't make a lot of money in the beginning, you know. But as you keep climbing up, you make a little bit more money. But the hours are long, mm-hmm. and it's a lot of work. You know, being a chef in New Orleans is a lot of work. You know, it's the things that you got to do, man, to get the job done. It's unbelievable. But like I said, this is not an industry that you're going to be rich overnight. Like, you're in it because you love it, mm-hmm. and because that's what you love to do. Like, I never went into it like, oh, I'm going to be rich or this is going to make me a ton of money. Never thought about it that way.
Yeah, because usually the answer is like, hey, how do I make money in the food industry? And you go, choose a different industry.
All right, choose a different industry. So it's like, you really have to, like, your priorities in your mind to pick this career have to be in it.
Yeah.
100%. Like, I never did anything outside of cooking. I just enjoyed it. But as I'm getting older, you know, the things that I did when I was 20-year-old, I'm getting older, man. I got kids now. So things change, but like I ended up doing pop-ups. I moved here like 4 years ago, and then like I didn't know what to do. So I kind of like my wife got a job up here. And we're like, you know what? You can do pop-ups. So I started doing pop-ups out of my apartment in the North Loop.
That's awesome.
And the reason that started because I watched that documentary from that guy who got a Michelin star out of his apartment in Chicago. Except that guy beat up his wife.
We're not saying that part was good, but the apartment part was cool.
The idea was great. Not related to that crazy guy. He went nuts.
Here on the Folly Coffee Podcast, that is bad. We do not endorse that. Anyway, you're doing pop-ups.
But I took the idea from him and kind of just started doing pop-ups. I charged $75 a head in my apartment.
Who are the people that are coming to this? Is it like people you know, or is it word of mouth? How are you getting people as you're doing these pop-ups to kind of get like show up?
Yeah, like we call it the underground Minneapolis. And this is like all word of mouth. So like you would tell a friend or tell another friend, and you would come in and I have this like 5-course dinner in my house and wine and dine in my apartment. And then it took off from me like doing it in my apartment to like doing them in people's like rooftops in the North Loop. And then so my job was like discretion, like discreet things that nobody else would do. Like, I tell you something, I can't really say much because
there's
some things that I shouldn't say this.
All right, then don't. I do not want to be the person that incriminates you on this podcast.
No, it's not incriminating, but it's really wild.
We can talk about it over a drink another time.
Yeah, it's something that you would not believe it happened, but it's out of a movie.
Yeah.
But then you're like, oh, really, that happens? Like, yeah, like. It's wild as it sounds.
It's like, how often are you doing these pop-ups as you're doing them?
I was doing them like once a month.
Okay.
Twice a month.
So pretty frequently. And then how long did that go before you kind of started to formulate the idea of what ultimately becomes Guacaya?
So like right before COVID, I went ahead and tried to work at Spoon and Stable, man. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my mentor, Adolfo Garcia in New Orleans, is another mentor of mine. Adolfo Garcia, who is friends with Daniel Bulot, told me, like, yeah, man, like, I know Gavin, like, I know Daniel, like, go over there, tell him, you know, use me as reference.
Yeah.
It's a small world.
Yeah, yeah.
These people know each other. And then Adolfo Garcia is a prominent name in New Orleans, and he's Panamanian like me, which I love that. And, you know. But also, I worked in, like I said, I worked at Cochon Butcher thing. I worked at Bado Bistro with Chef Edgar Caro, like best chef of 2018, 2019. Mm-hmm. And then I was really good friends with Chef Adolfo Garcia from Panama.
Yeah, so it's like you've got this resume that's like, come on.
So and then I worked at Commander's Palace for a little bit, mm-hmm. too, and that was fun. A lot of a structure. So Commander's Palace is similar to Spanish Table. I guess like a galley-style mm-hmm. kitchen where you have a team. But so I went to work there right before COVID hit. And you know, I thought I could do that, and I feel like I was just too old for it. You know, because, like, let's be honest, when I was working there, Chris and I were the oldest in the kitchen, and some of the associates, mm-hmm. Koji, I think it's his name, and then Diane. But then, like, everybody else, like, 17, like, 18-year-old, 19. Some of them never kissed a girl, never had a drink.
When I worked in the bakery at Belcour for a year when I was building Folly, and at the time I was 26, and I was by far the oldest person, at least on the front of the house for the bakery as a barista.
Which it wasn't bad. I was the lead, the line lead.
Yeah, okay.
The whole thing. And I was doing the grill, eating all the smoke and all that. And, you know, it was great. I think it was great, but it's just kind of, it put me off that everybody was so young. And I guess I'm like, it just didn't click quite like I thought it was going to be. I guess my expectation of what it was going to be did not resonate with my age and body at that time. Because by then, I haven't done a, except for Commander's Palace, that did another galley kitchen like that. So my experience going into it, my mind was saying, yes, I want to do it. And then my body was like, and my mind did, when I was working it, I was like, man, I'm too old for this. But it wasn't a bad experience, and this is where Wakaya Bistro was born. When I went to do that for work for Gavin at Spoon and Stable, one day, like, it's like at midnight, I just woke up, like, had like an epiphany moment in my life. I just looked at myself at 3 a.m. in the morning. It's like around, I don't know why I woke up, but I woke up with like an urge or something that tells me, like, I told myself I'm going to have a restaurant. And from the moment that happened, that I just woke up, that, like, I just went in like beast mode. No, it's crazy. I went to beast mode to open Wakaya Bistro. And I had it in my mind, and like, I felt like I was procrastinating in my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that.
Which, like, it's an easy thing to procrastinate. If things are going all right, it's kind of easy to get comfortable. It's easy to get complacent. And, you know, so at some point you're going to look back and say, I should have done something, but it's a lot easier to just not.
And, you know, like, getting a job was when the stable was a lot easier than I was hoping for, I guess. And that also made me complacent. I think it's like, no, the fact that I can just have any job that I have because of my resume.
Yeah, which is a pretty insane resume.
But it also is like makes you complacent, like the fact that you know you can get any job that you want. Like it's good and bad.
Yeah.
Because you get very complacent and then you just like get in a rot. So that one day, I don't know, I just woke up, and then I woke up, my wife said, hey, we're going to have a restaurant. I told her, like, I think like that out of nowhere. And then from that point, then I just went crazy. I just went crazy trying to open a restaurant, getting more pop-ups, getting more funding. And then, like, we were getting ready to open it up in the St. Anthony neighborhood by Northeast Minneapolis.
Yep.
And we almost signed the lease to open Wakaya Bistro. There's like a pizzeria, coffee shop, and it's like a little theater office, St. Anthony. I don't know, it's called St. Anthony something. It's just like
St. Anthony, Maine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there was like an old used to be like a grocery shop.
Okay.
We signed the lease for that. And before we signed the lease, the landlord kind of calls us and be like, hey guys, like, I think we should talk about this thing that's happening in the world. It's like, what are you talking about? Like,
oh, God.
This COVID thing. It's like, he's like, I don't know what's going on right now, but I'm terrified because this is the first time, you know, my family from overseas called me to see if we're okay. And it's usually me calling them if they're all right. Mm. And he said, like, I don't know what's going on, but I can tell you that you shouldn't do this right now. We ripped the contract, the lease. And then, like, 2 weeks later, the country shuts down.
I mean, looking back, you know, that was a super nice thing, it seems, that he did at the time. I'm sure you were probably a little ticked off when he did it, that you're like, what the hell? We had a deal. And then that goes to, how do you feel after the fact? How do you feel when he's like, this is off?
No, and I'm also was kind of worried because then you saw the people down in Italy, and you're like, is this shit real? Is this coming here?
Yeah.
And then I just started second guessing myself, like, what's going on? Like, something bad's going to happen, because now I'm looking at the news and people are dying.
Yeah.
And I'm like, fuck, man, it's like, this is the right time to do this? I don't know. So I just went along with it. It's like, he's like, trust me, it'll be for the best. And it turned out to be for the best.
Yeah, what a, I mean, there's probably a lot of people that if they saw it coming, they were like, I need to get this lease signed today to make sure that I got these payments coming in during all this weird time.
Yeah, but, you know, I didn't get any PPP or any of that stuff.
Yeah.
Because we're not opening.
Yeah.
But then, you know, it was pretty crazy the last few years. And then I kind of like, the 2 years I was during COVID, I just kind of volunteered cooking here and there, helping here, like wherever I could help out and volunteer sometimes, because like I couldn't do pop-ups.
Yeah.
Because by then, I already had my first child, and then doing pop-ups at home was impossible. Mm. So now I moved it to a kitchen in Central Avenue, the Central Mix. It's called the Central Mix. Mm. And then I was doing my pop-ups out of that place. So I would do 45 people. So I went up from like just
however many people you could fit in your apartment.
Yeah, to now doing like 45 people. I bought tables and everything. So, and then like, you know, I couldn't do any more pop-ups, cook anymore. Mm. So just volunteered my time. I joined like the Northwood Neighborhood Association board member, tried to do community service as much as I could. I met a lot of great people during that time of community service that I did. Because I was like, as a chef, what do? You either get laid off like everybody else, or you do something productive with your time. So
Based on your story so far, I would have a guess as to how you would do that. And that's a pretty damn effective use of time that I think a lot of people are like, oh, all right, time to relax for a while, or, you know, whatever, to each their own. But to go out and be like, I'm going to get on the board of directors here. I'm going to go check this out. Is that ultimately what kind of led to finding the space that you're in now, or how did that come together?
So, yeah, I became friends with a lot of people who had a lot of good influence in the city, like Jackson Schwartz, who owns Hennepin Made, who owns that glass house. Mm-hmm. Super influential guy, super community driven. I love that guy. It's like I really look up to Jackson a lot. I met Dana, who owns Martin Patrick. Mm-hmm. I became one of my best friends. Mm-hmm. I don't buy anything out of his shop. <really good friend. laughs> So Dana was a huge supporter of us, and then you meet the people from the city, council members. You start getting into this politics and things, and how to improve your community. Mm-hmm. And you know, the Northwood didn't need anything, but we needed to help others. And during this time, we had the riots, George Floyd. We had, you know, there's food insecurity for people. People were out of a job. There were the pantry lines to go get food were getting heavy. So we were orchestrating like food drives in the Northwood because we knew they had a little extra to give. Mm. You know, they have a lot of disposable income. So we went into like gift mode. How to help those communities, South Minneapolis. How to help those communities in North Minneapolis, collect food, collect things that people, basic necessities that people need, toilet paper and all that mm-hmm. stuff, and try to help the community during the rough times. And through the process, I think I met an incredible amount of people. I even had to like help out with the encampment in the North Loop. I used to mm. me and Scott Waller from coffee shop. He owns what's that coffee shop? Scott Waller owns all.
What area?
It's right next to like Rice Bagel, in the North Loop.
Oh, Corner Coffee.
Corner Coffee.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. He's a pastor, so I used to get like donations, like go get like bagels from Rice Bagels, and the manager just gave me a bunch of bagels and cream cheese, and I get free coffee and chocolate, and I used to go to the encampment and just like try to help these people. Like,
yeah,
they're fucking down and out, man. Like, they just need a little help. So I used to go there, drop coffee, bagel, and then one of the guys that was there, he passed away. And so
take a minute, you're good.
So, you know, the encampment in the North Loop was really complicated. And it has nothing to do with culinary, but it just had to do with a rough time that we were going
yeah.
through. But we had meetings about the community, about the encampment, not being safe. There were shootings and things happening out of there. But I met Mo, the leader of the encampment. And, you know, he told me more about his story. You know, that there were good people in that encampment. So, in our history, he came to one of the board members' meetings. Freaking changed me, you know what I mean? So, we tried to help him as much as we can. We gathered food, bringing things over. But then he passed away. And kind of, you know, it's real people.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, eventually the encampment got, you know, closed down and moved away, but you know, you just get like involved in your community, try to do the best thing you can. Then after all of that, then Wakaya came into play. It's just so much, man, that happened in those 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, so much that's happened in the past 20 years for you. It's unbelievable. Like, this is 8 separate stories. Like, this is as much as some people go through in a lifetime that you've experienced in all these different phases of your story, going from Panama to New Orleans to Vegas to, I mean, spending time in China, spending time in Jamaica, spending time in Tijuana, spending time in LA to moving up here. And it's wild, man. It's a lot to process. Have you ever taken a step back and really processed how wild everything, like where you have been during the past 15, many years of your life?
Well, it's been so much, man. Like, even the George Floyd thing, I was really involved in it because my wife is African-American and my children are black. So, you know, for me, racial equality is important. So I was out there every day with them. You know, I was in the bridge when that semi almost came and hit us. Jeez. So, like, even passing water to the whole, like, you know, protest and, you know, we participated in all the peaceful protests. Like, I didn't take part of any of the negative stuff, but definitely the meaning behind it and having African-American children, my wife African-American too, it's important for me to, like, be present
yeah.
and fight for those same rights for my kids, you know. So they're already black. They're already behind. So, like, you know, I got to have conversations with them that nobody else has to have.
Yeah.
What does it mean to put your hands up? What does that mean to you? Like, you know, tell them, what does it mean when a cop stops you? What, you know, I got to talk about the color of the skin. You know, this is things like Chef Robert has to have conversations with yeah. kids too. He's got a, you know, diverse family too. So it's like, those things are important. Like I said, all that should happen. And I was trying to open Wakaya Bistro, dude. Isn't that crazy?
Which already on its own, like opening a restaurant is like, will put a lot of people, will bury a lot of people, the amount of work man. And planning and preparation and anxiety and everything that goes into it.
Yeah, and then I had to put everything on hold because like banks were now lending money during the COVID.
Yeah.
And then we had the riot and the whole thing. So things, so I kind of tried to, like I said, use my time to like help people. The best I could, man. So, and then like I said, leave the world better than you found it. That's the goal, man, every day. So like with that, after all the whole thing, here here we are, fast forward like 7 months ago, 9 months ago. My business partner, he was still there. My business partner name is Giancarlo Quintero. He's from Panama, the same town I'm from. He's a modern day G.I. Joe. You know, call him a James Bond. So he works for the Department of Defense, and he makes sure that our troops are safe. And I really don't know. He's in Iraq right now. So, and he had his own sets of challenges, man. He was in Afghanistan during the evacuation of the Afghan people.
Oh, jeez.
And his job was to make sure they didn't blow up the planes while they were getting people into their planes. And like I said, he just worked for the Department of Defense, making sure that his job is to make sure that the perimeter around the airport was not compromised. Yeah. So when the bomb went off, he was close to it and he felt the shock waves.
Jeez.
So, and then you're hearing the news like a year and a half before that, an explosion that went off in Iraq or something that ended up killing some military folks. He was nearby also when that happened. So my business partner also, like, it's crazy, man. Both of our lives are nuts. And like, we always think about it.
What you guys must view is like challenging or difficult. You're like, it's just hard work.
it's funny because we think about it like, holy shit, like, you ever thought that we're never going to leave Panama and the small town that we were from? And I think, you know, honestly, like, we think we would have had a good life.
Yeah.
I think it would have been modest. We don't have any of the modern things, but we would have been perfectly happy, I think, living in Panama in that small town of Panama. Mm-hmm. But, you know, life takes you where it takes you, man.
I see, that's a little bit of an understatement, but
no, but like, I think during the pandemic, I really got to love Minneapolis and the people. I think it shows that there's a lot of great people in the city and that they're new for, you know, I haven't even got to my restaurant, but I think people are ready for something new.
Yeah.
And it's also like difficult for me too the first year because I'm still telling my story. People don't know me from a hole in the wall.
Yeah.
They just know that this guy from New Orleans opened up a restaurant and in the North Loop of all places, right?
Yeah.
But because of COVID, I was able to open, believe it or not, it's good and bad that it happened. But for me, it was like it benefited me, a small business owner, too, because I got a better deal to get in the North Loop that I would have got otherwise.
Yeah, that was a huge shift that happened during COVID as all these vacancies popped up. The power kind of shifted from the landlord to back to the restaurateurs. And so all of a sudden that negotiating power really did shift it. And
yeah.
Man, I've been twice, and both times, like I said, different experience from counter service to full service. But last time me and my buddy Kamal stopped in, and it was like, I just like things that I go, I haven't had anything like this, especially right in the Twin Cities. And the cocktail program, the food menu, it's just like, and the way I went back is basically there was this moment on social media. I don't know why it happened, but all of a sudden it's almost like people figured out about it. And I've seen everybody post about it. I'm like, I got to go back. Cause I'm always one that the first time I go to a place, I never like hang my hat on that and say, that's what this place is. Cause everybody changes. And all of a sudden I'm seeing it everywhere. I'm like, I got to go back. And then we happened to run into each other. I was like, I got to have this guy. Little did I know what story. Cause it's like, yeah, listen, I
my
you know,
life is a
looked
movie.
Up. Yeah. Looked up your name. And I'm like, okay. You know, he's from New Orleans. Okay. That explains some of the kind of the style. Okay, cool. Let's talk about it. And then meanwhile, I'm like, holy shit. I'm wiped out just hearing your story, dude, let alone the past 15 years of doing what you've been doing, man.
Dude, my story is like a movie.
listen, when most people say my life's like a movie, I go, okay. I just heard your story and I'm going to have to 100% agree with you. Man, I'm telling you what, I got a jet, but I don't want to cut this short, but like, we finally got to the restaurant. It is open in the North Loop. Check it out. Yeah, it is, man. Delicious. The cocktail program, incredibly unique. And man, I really appreciate the time to tell your story.
Man, we can talk about the restaurant all the time, but I think we're open. We're excited to bring something different. So I chose to stay closer to my culture, mm-hmm. where I grew up, the things that I love, New Orleans and Latin Caribbean cuisine, and that's what we're doing. You know, we don't take ourselves serious, but we're serious about what we do.
Yeah,
and We have a passion to do great things. And I think going from QR code to full service has really helped us a lot.
Yeah.
Getting reservations. And also my chef de cuisine moved from Panama to help me open Huacaya Bistro, Ricky.
That Santo. Is awesome.
So we have a great group of people that makes the restaurant run. We're super excited every day. Of course, December, January are slow days for us, yep. but we're super excited that, you know, and looking forward for the summer right now.
Yeah. Well, man, I really appreciate the time. You really didn't have to do this. I appreciate you coming in, and hopefully this helps you get your story out just a little bit more.
Yeah, man.
I'll end it like I do every other episode and say, have a nice day.